have a little less than 2 hours to go.
Was that supposed to be?
Oh, a little less than 2 hours in this first. I'm sorry it's so short. And then we take a break for a few minutes. Let's go on to the next one. Normative judgments about disparities measures. We're in section 4F, which is on page, my remiss, I'm not telling you which page we're on here. 4F on page 33. Section 4F. Is that it? I was looking at that going, didn't look right. 4E, right above 4F, conveniently. And the question is, what can be recommended to minimize normative judgments in the selection of disparity-sensitive measures? Can objective criteria be identified in this regard? And what we were discussing up here among the NQF staff and the co-chairs is that I think what we're going to try to do here is, instead of getting closure around recommendations per se, that the focus should really be on discussion of these points and trying to give staff direction for then formulating at least drafting a direction that we can then consider later, if I've captured that correctly. Okay.
Right. If something is clearly, bright line, and we can move on with the recommendations, and I think we should go for it. But the last couple, we've kind of gone round and round and then beat the horse really dead, and I only want to be sort of dead, so we can move on that way.
Yeah, and we've had a reconsideration. We're probably going to aim to close at 5, so it's been a long day. So we'll see if we can, we'll get as far as we can by about 5 o'clock. Okay. So, Section 4F. Do you have any open comments, Joel, on 4F?
Not really. Although, I'm wondering if the question should be to minimize normative judgments, or if NQF ought to make the normative judgment in its recommendations. That would be the only comment I'd have. And I guess, as an example, I think an example helps. Talking about this Healthy People 2010 report, right? And the normative judgment that came into play there was around the summary index, which had a bunch of different groups, and they decided that they would compare each subgroup to a reference group, and that each one would count equally. And that was the normative judgment they made. They made a judgment saying that each group had equal importance, no matter how small the group was. And you could make a different judgment saying, boy, you should weight those contributions by the size, by the population size. That's an example of a normative judgment. The other one has to do with, should the least healthy group make the most progress? There are a number of different things, and the statistic that you choose can influence the kind of progress that you show. And so I think this is just, this, you know, we were just doing our job in terms of raising these issues so that you at least consider them.
This is actually an interesting variable and a measure that we looked at before, where it may again require further drilling down on the measure, and the reference point for normative may be up for consideration as well. Because in the work that we did looking at changes in the 100 largest cities and suburbs over time, we picked low birth weight as a variable to examine. We found that the trend at the point, this is back in the 90s to the 2000 census data, that there had actually been an improvement in some of the minority populations, while there had been an increase in the majority of the advantaged populations, so-called. And it wasn't until you looked further into the information about low birth weight that you realized that it had to do with multiple births that were occurring among women who were holding off on having children later in life, and that it was happening in weird places statistically you hadn't thought of, like the suburbs, that you were seeing this up there. So it's just kind of a number reference point that the issues around normative and perspective on numbers may need to be taken into consideration at another level as you try to identify those reference points for these populations. Comments on normative judgment?
I think it's just important just to recognize that they're implicit in the way we measure things and the way we weight things, but I think this is posed as a problem, and I'm not sure it's a problem.
Elizabeth?
I just want to say I agree with Joel. I mean, I think we should make recommendations about what's normative. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what measuring disparities is all about, right? Aren't we making normative judgments? I mean, what's good?
So on the table, questions about normative judgments. What are they? Luther?
I was just going to say I agree, and maybe just a statement that a reference should be made to minimize normative judgments.
To what?
Excuse me?
Reference to what?
The bias that is inherent in.
So reference to minimize normative judgments. And what?
Inherent bias.
Other tents?
Anyone have any other comments on this issue?
What, Ellen?
I don't understand. Sorry. Might be too late in the day for me. Can you define normative judgment?
Yeah.
Is this from what I understood what Liz was saying, it's what the standard should be, like what the improvement should try to achieve.
You could think of a number of different things. That's a good question. What do you want to achieve? Do you want to bring minority populations up to the white population, or do you want everybody to improve? That's one value choice. You know, that's a value choice. Do you think that all groups should be equal, or are you more concerned about the more populous minority populations and focus on them? I don't know, people help me out. I mean, I think if you just continue to ask that question, what do you want to achieve? That's a value judgment, normative judgment, obviously use values. And it turns out that the measure that you select or the statistic that you select can often, some people think, reflects the value judgments of the people who select that statistic. The CDC believes that all groups should contribute equally, no matter their size. And so in Healthy People 2010, they report a summary statistic where each group contributes equally. That's a value judgment. I'm just raising the issue.
Can we agree that it just needs to be mentioned and, you know, just move on?
That's what I heard. That's cool.
Well, I guess that's fine, and it feels like there are a lot of these questions that we're theoretically talking about now, which is going to happen really in the future when we look at the measures and the data. And I know we're trying to set some parameters or guidelines, but that particularly for this instance, it feels like when there's a red flag in particular, it maybe should get vetted somewhere. If there's a decision to be made over one over the other value in what statistic or what goal we're trying to achieve, it feels like there should be some process to
I think
for input.
My sense here is, though, we can't identify a single rule set.
No, right. I guess it's more about process. That when this issue comes up, there's a process for input. That there's a tangible example on the table. Does anybody understand?
I'm just trying to make it relevant but not more complex than it needs to be. And I think in this case, merely mentioning it should be sufficient. However, if there is a situation that comes up that we should discuss and vet in, you know, more detail, we certainly can do that. But right now, at this juncture, I really think that just including it is. And I just want to make sure that the group is in agreement with that.
Yeah, I'll just make one more comment. I think it's important for, as you're making these recommendations, to just kind of keep this in the back of your head and think of, like, you know, how it's going to play in Peoria. I always tell my kids who live in the People's Republic of Cambridge, it's kind of like this room, you know, we're pretty well a liberal group. But imagine if there was some sort of incentive program that encouraged the reduction of disparities. In order to do that, some health plan actually made the quality of care for white non-Hispanic worse. You know, I mean, I think in certain parts of the country, that wouldn't play so well. And in thinking about how, and it's not just about measures. I mean, we talk a lot about measure selection, but we're going beyond measure selection here, I think. We're talking about reporting of differences in measures, and that's where the rubber hits the road, and people were talking about how this is a very charged area, and so I just think it's just maybe move on. We should just say it's an issue and move on.
Okay, it's an issue and we're moving on. Okay, we're going to skip down to the second last bullet in this long list to risk adjustment and stratification, and that's section 4II. That's on page 39 and 40 and 41. and with the recommendation that performance reports stratified by race, ethnicity should not be risk adjusted by SES or other contributory factors. Instead, should be further stratified if the data permit. And the question to us, as you can read, should stratification by race, ethnicity, primary language be performed when there is sufficient data to do so? Should NQF review its policy on risk adjustment vis-a-vis inclusion of race, ethnicity? It's in the list on the agenda. It's on page 2 of the agenda.
Page four
of the agenda. I think Elizabeth.
I have a question. Isn't this redundant with what we talked about before? Because you said we're going to pull out these measures on which we're going to ask people to stratify and race ethnicity, right? I guess I need clarification on the question because didn't we already discuss that?
I guess I was wondering about this too. It seemed like we had a discussion saying as much as you can, you want to do that. You want to stratify by race, ethnicity, and language. So is this a kind of a revisiting or has another angle?
I think it has another angle, mainly in terms of risk adjustment for outcomes. I think that's for sure. Take care of that, Marcella. So one of the issues that comes up repeatedly is outcome measures come to us, especially by these other measure developers. They've done their risk adjustment models, and lo and behold, race, ethnicity is significant, as is gender, as maybe SES. They put them in their models, they bring them to us, and we have traditionally said no race, ethnicity, or language in our models, that we want to be able to stratify by those results. We don't want them buried in our risk adjustment model. This comes up, I was just downtown at a CMS meeting, I was just asked this question 15 minutes ago. So this is an issue that comes up constantly when you're using measures ultimately to pay for performance. So we feel like we're on solid ground, but we thought it was an important issue because it keeps coming up, and the stakes have gotten higher and higher, especially with readmission measures, for example, with a penalty coming in 2014. There continue to be concerns people have raised that some hospitals in very poor communities, for example, may not do well. But again, it's more philosophical, but we thought it was important to bring it to this group.
And just as a further level of clarity, there are, you know, to simplify, there are two levels of the risk adjustment question. So first of all, it should be clear, now we're talking about, you know, an overall measure of quality, and should you risk adjust for race and ethnicity when there's an assumption that certain minority patients have poorer quality of care, are you going to be disadvantaging the population, the provider? The second level of that is when you're looking at, when you're identifying disparities, should you then risk adjust for socioeconomic status and other social determinants? That's a separate question, but you could adjust for all those at the same time. You know, Sean can probably tell you, you can throw everything in the model at once, but I think there are different conceptual issues for each of those two questions. Good luck.
Laura?
I'm confused. Can you just explain what NQF's current policy is? I missed that. I'm sorry, I didn't quite get it.
I probably need more decongestion. So the current policy is that NQF precludes the inclusion, that doesn't allow the inclusion of race, ethnicity, and gender in risk models, and indicates to developers that they've mentioned that those results should be stratified rather than risk adjusted for those variables, exactly for the reason of being concerned of masking disparities. But because it keeps coming up, we thought it'd be worth raising it again. And recently, the conversation has shifted a bit to saying, okay, not race, ethnicity, language, let's talk SES, let's talk income, let's talk geography, let's talk some of those other issues, which are, you know, other considerations. So,
I guess I'm confused about, you're saying it's not masked, it's stratified by. Maybe that's because I don't...
If it's in the model, you can't stratify it. You've adjusted those different
things. Okay. Got it.
Okay. Maybe you can give an example of how it would be used. Stratified versus risk adjustment.
If you tell me I can't stratify by it later, I'm fine. I agree. Yeah.
What does the risk model you can't stratify by it? So basically, if the model, like some of the FTS measures, for example, coming with cardiac surgery measures, do have traditionally in the past, if they do anymore, included, Shishan would know this, race ethnicity. And so once it's in the model, you then can't afterward post hoc show how it's stratified. Do you want to respond? Sean, you've thought a lot about this. Do you want to?
I'll try. I mean, I think my personal position is it really depends on the particular purpose of what you're trying to do with the measure, and there's not a one-size answer. It's really context-dependent. Traditionally, when you think about risk adjustment, conceptually the question you're asking is, what would the outcomes of this particular unit look like if the case mix was not the actual case mix that they treated, but some other case mix, and standardizing that case mix. And conceptually the idea is to take factors that are present at the point of where the care episode begins, and then you might generalize that and really think really present before the time frame of accountability begins, really, maybe, and try to don't adjust for factors that were within the control of the healthcare provider or the things that you might want accountability for, because then you would adjust away the differences that you're trying to measure. But I think it gets, I can imagine exceptions to the rule in scenarios where gender, for example, it is a reasonable question to ask. You really think that there's something about women where there's differences that are not explained by any quality difference, anything that providers are doing, but in cardiac surgery, sewing around the aorta or into the size of the anatomy can really make a difference in terms of how long the operation takes and things like that. So there may be just inherent differences, and I'm probably saying things that are wrong, and there's probably people who disagree on that, but I think there is a perspective that said, well, if you're trying to estimate this standardized difference, then sure, you could have gender in the model, and that you still want to address these gender disparity issues, but maybe that's a separate topic. And I think to me the risk is that we have kind of normative goals and policy goals, and separate kind of just being able to define and estimate some quantity. If your goal is to estimate some quantity, you want to define that quantity and estimate it the right way. You don't want to leave something out of your analysis that makes you not estimate what you think you're estimating. So that's my thought.
Edward?
Yeah, I guess I would sort of echo a lot of what you said. So there, you may think that you're on solid ground, but I think the ground is not as solid as you think it is because of the biologic and genetic issues that are inherent, certainly in gender and to some extent in race and ethnicity. So the issue with cardiac surgery, for instance, is that women have higher mortality than men. Is that a disparity, or is it related to, as Sean was saying, the fact that surgery takes longer, is technically more difficult because of body size? I would maintain that as the latter, that there is a real biologic difference there, and by failing to adjust for gender, you have created a disparity perhaps where none exists. I can make similar arguments with regard to race in congestive heart failure, incidence of atrial fibrillation, markedly different in African Americans, and so the prognosis would essentially be better. So you would expect, on a genetic or biologic basis, there to be better outcomes in African Americans. So equal outcomes is actually a disparity in that case. Failing to adjust gives you a false impression of reality. And then the socioeconomic, failing to adjust for socioeconomic position, I think you've probably heard a lot of pushback that for some measures, things like 30-day readmission, failing to adjust for socioeconomic position puts safety net hospitals that disproportionately care for the disadvantaged, puts them at a distinct disadvantage with regard to pay for performance and public reporting and all that sort of stuff, because the determinants are social and are things that hospitals don't have control over. And so I think that it might be reasonable to continue the policy as you've had it, but there needs to be some caveat or some statement that goes along with that said, we are aware of the problems that this approach is creating.
Marshall, then Elizabeth, then Marshall.
I'm going to respectfully disagree with that position. I used to work at a disparity institution for a county hospital in Chicago, and really, we should design our care to serve our patients who happen to be quite disadvantaged. I think it's important to know, I really appreciated in the report that there was this discussion about really not adjusting for these things because then you don't see the racial disparity. I mean, unfortunately, these things really co-occur, race and lower socioeconomic status in this country and higher socioeconomic status. And it's our job as healthcare providers and institutions to actually address them. And if we take away those differences by adjusting for those things, it doesn't give us an opportunity to recognize what are the determinants of what happened and then to address them. And I would also argue that, and Bill's really the expert on this, but, you know, this issue of genes versus what happens in the environment, I mean, it's not clear that people are necessarily going to be more disadvantaged biologically, but that the stresses of their life, because they happen to be a different race, puts them at a disadvantage biologically. And so I think it's really hard to sort that out, but really it's our job. Even if it were genetic, we would still have to do a better job of taking care of them because they're at higher risk, and we should know that.
Can I respond to that? I think I think maybe you misunderstood where I was coming from here. I think that the issue with, I agree that systems should be designed to take care of the patients that they are responsible for taking care of. However, the current systems are such that, with pay for performance and things like that, that if you penalize people whose care is more expensive to provide to the patients that they are responsible for, you've done them a great disservice. You've done them, you've hit them twice, essentially. And, I agree that, if you're at Cook County in Chicago, that taking care of a group of patients who has trouble getting to appointments because they can't afford cab fare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, providing them with that stuff is going to provide them better care. But it's more expensive, and it's more resource intense. And the current system takes resources, potentially takes resources away rather than adds resources in.
Yeah, I think that actually what Ed and Liz and which all run in the paper are all consistent. I think it's actually one of the elegant things about the paper, in that it shows us, though, that we can't just stop at doing the descriptive work with the disparity measurement, but because the implications downstream, we have to include all this implementation issue in the recommendations. In other words, we're saying don't stratify, don't include race, ethnicity within the risk adjustment models because we want to stratify so we can see if there are differences. As we have the point that, well, it can lead to problematic issues like with this, I guess, hospital compare program to the readmissions where you're penalizing the Cook Counties of the world. And that was like another part of the paper where it's saying, well, we need to build into the implementation safeguards to prevent the rich getting richer problem. So, whether there are additional QI resources for Cook Counties or the idea about risk-adjusted reimbursement. So in other words, once you start down this pathway, it means that we have to do it all in terms of, and I think we do have to do it all in terms of going through these different scenarios for implementation. Otherwise, you put down one thing which helps the disparities, but they can hurt unless they're all addressed. So I think we are on a pathway that I think we need to do of being comprehensive, just like the paper was comprehensive.
Other comments? Elizabeth?
I don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry, Colette, you were in the queue.
Actually, I think Marshall covered it. I was just going to say that we do on the page 8 really lays out a lot of lovely options, I think, and the whole, it's not immediately clear to me, and I'm just trying to think it through, if you embed it versus you kind of do it after the fact, is it always going to be the case that you won't pick something up? But the bigger statement really is related to what Marshall said, and that we definitely need to pay attention to this one because it is going to be tied to dollars, and that's only going to be more and more and more true. So you just have to safeguard against whichever choice we make so that the people who are taking care of the patients with the issue get the resources that they need to do that.
Okay.
I just want to say at the risk of Dennis asking earlier if I'm always a troublemaker, and I said yes, I have a reputation in my family, and I may have it here, but I just want to actually put forth that, I mean, this is a really tough word to use, but this is how racism gets institutionalized. If we have a system that penalizes people or organizations for taking care of people who happen to be disadvantaged, then what we do is then, so then we can't measure it. We can't measure that they're disadvantaged. We can't measure the ways in which they experience disparities because it would penalize these organizations. That's the way this all stays quiet. And so I thought the ideas that you put forth, Joel, in the report were really creative about actually paying people more to take care of poor people instead of disadvantaging them. And in fact, maybe paying them even more if you lower the risk of that institution. Could you imagine if there were a certain risk at Cook County and then you pay them more to take care of them and then you also give them some incentive to bring it down? I mean, there's different ways you could do it. I think there's other models to think about how we pay. I just don't want the current models, which I think unfortunately ask us not to ask these hard questions and keep us from asking these hard questions or measuring these things, not to let them determine what we do.
But I think what that does, though, your comments also are kind of a little bit, kind of a bookend to Marshall's, or work well with Marshall's comment in the sense that there's an obligation then to make sure that this is explicated in some way, shape, or form, because if it were done in, as Denise has said, kind of in this academic abstract of, you know, well, let's present these data in this way, and let's not stratify on these indicators, then it could very those points could very well get lost in the discussion. Therefore, it kind of comes back to your point, Marshall, that if you're going to start down this path, then you've got to follow through. You've got to also acknowledge these other elements. You know, Joel's good and Joe's good presentation notwithstanding on this point. I think we may need to explicate on this, on these other indicators to make sure that we're not institutionalizing racism further, but at the same time we're not dooming these providers to insufficient dollars and insufficient support to actually carry out these more complex social determinants, in particular related challenges. I'm sorry.
I have a comment, and thanks for bringing page 8 up. I've made a note here. I just want to reiterate, I believe Gracie had brought it up earlier. One of the things I feel is missing in here, again, is we're talking about the provider. We're talking from the standpoint of practitioner and the patient. But I think if we're going to meet some standards that can be met by health systems, we really have to think in a global standpoint, something that affects system-wide. I'm thinking of the person who takes care of the patient 24/7, the nurses, the respiratory therapist, and it has to come from above. So we really have to think more globally as far as much like Joint Commission does or CMS does, that we really have to set some standards that are more or less implied institutional-wide. And I think a lot has been, the onus has been put on the practitioner and the patient, but I really think to really drill down to where it's a win-win for everyone, it has to hit everyone in that organization. And the only way I think we can do that is to hit, that's what I feel is missing here, some system-wise, because it's a health system, they're ultimately going to start the continuum of care that goes on onto the outpatient basis. And throughout this, I felt some of those measures were missing.
Yeah, in some ways, that point kind of reflects back to our discussion. Since what comes to mind for me also is in the case of safety net organizations, one thing is primary care or emergency care, the other is specialty care, getting referrals. And if you're going to penalize some of the safety net institutions for not having access to safety net specialty care, that has to be done. That should be done, and it has to be taken into consideration in the context of this systemic viewpoint, rather than just simply the practitioner or the individual.
Yeah,
I do have a comment. This issue of risk adjustment, it is very nuanced, and I do agree with your recommendation, Joe, in the paper, which you suggested in terms of risk adjusting the payment to the providers, which you had mentioned. I totally agree with that. My concern is that if we say we don't want to risk adjust, but yet this group, this body, has no impact on the policies as it relates to paying providers, we're basically saying don't do this, but we're penalized as providers on the other end. If we take care of large groups of minority patients, and there is no differential in terms of our payment. So we're saying don't do this, but we really have no authority over what providers are going to get. So I'm trying to put a very realistic framework. In my group here in D.C., we are the largest provider of primary care services for underserved kids. So most of 90%+ of our kids are Medicaid enrolled children, and 90% are minorities. So, the risk adjustment issue is a very real question for us, particularly when we're not getting any added payments for all the extra effort that it takes to raise the bar for these kids. So I'm just trying to be very realistic about what it means if they don't risk adjust, but on the other hand, we don't have any say-so in terms of how much we can pay for.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my answer, and I think I'm sort of aligned with Liz's comments, but with real appreciation for what's going on, and I think perhaps one of the values of what this group can do is to really highlight this issue. And I mean, people are talking about it, but I don't think you're giving it enough attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I it is some lip service. I think I mentioned here there was, a letter from the AHA or something. But there's, people have to change policies to address this. That they have to realize that providers with disadvantaged populations have a tougher time and have poorer outcomes. And we don't want to institutionalize those outcomes and excuse them. Right, we want equitable care for everybody, but on the other hand, it's a resource issue. And, don't get me started, I think if anything, the country's going the wrong direction. I mean, the gap between Medicaid and commercial insurance is getting bigger. That's exactly the wrong direction. So I think to the extent that that this group can really come out strongly about what the, why risk adjustment is fair and yet dangerous.
No, and I think it's important. I mean, another clear example is when we're caring for language minority kids, limited English proficient, populations. That, yeah, we care for them, but the issue is, in many places, there's no reimbursement for interpretive services. So, yeah, care for them, don't risk adjust, but incur the expense of, that is our reality.
Mary, then, Ernie?
So if we accomplish nothing more than what the conversation has been in the last 5 minutes, we've done a really good job. Now, if we can figure out how to make the policy follow our discussion. And I think the other piece is that we have to be aware that the more we fail to talk about the tough stuff, the more that we allow it to perpetuate. As an example, in many areas of Chicago, and I also trained at Cook County, we no longer have a trauma system because we've allowed people to withdraw from it because it's expensive. And so Lourdes and I, at the beginning of this meeting, were talking about the outcome related to Congresswoman Giffords being so wonderful because of her immediate access and sustained access to excellent care. And so if there's a way for us to impact the availability, accessibility, and mandate to require excellent care, we have more than done our job.
I would be hesitant to put out a message that don't risk adjust, period. But I do think that the way it's written is that instead of risk adjustment, you want to stratify. So you stratify, then you can compare apples with apples. You can compare each box, flax with flax, or low-income flax with low-income flax. And then it's a fair comparison. I think that's a good message, to stratify instead of risk adjustment. So maybe we should make
I'd like to point out that also has the danger of institutionalizing care. I mean, in spite of our recommendation, people shouldn't think that that solves the problem, right? Because imagine, I think you have to take the next step and understand how this could be used. And so if it's used for incentive payments. Stratification in some ways does nothing different because you say, oh, okay, your poor black populations are treated just as well or poorly as everybody else's, so you're okay. But at least it's more transparent, and so there are that's where the other policy recommendations that I made come into play, that we have to recognize, we have to be fair to the providers, but recognize that we need different policies to eliminate those disparities.
I would say that in terms of the entire report, whatever we submit, this is probably one of the most critical areas, and that it needs to be very nuanced. It needs to demonstrate to the public that we understand the issue and that we've looked at it from every perspective.
And that they're tied, but you can't do one without the other. I think we're going to Edward, and then Marshall, and then Deshaun.
Just wanted to maybe...
And Grace.
Clarify or propose that. I think what I've been trying to say is that not that you should change the policy. In other words, I don't think that risk adjustment for age, gender, socioeconomic status, I don't think it's a bad thing, and I think the policy should continue. I'm just asking that the policy come with an asterisk that says that there are times where failing to adjust for these things actually is having the opposite effect to what we intend. And I also agree with Joel that stratifying doesn't solve the problem with risk adjustment. So that's where I'm asking for an asterisk.
And I would add that it needs to be more than an asterisk. I think it's an important enough issue that it needs to be in the body of whatever, you know, not in a footnote, not as a, you know, as a sort of sidebar thing, but embedded in whatever it is.
In bold or italics?
Yeah, there you go.
Actually, to add to that, HRF does have a sub-criterion specifically on unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's important to actually tie these two together, stay grounded in the criteria as a logical approach, which I like.
Hey, on Laura's point about teams and care coordination, just reminded me that one thing that we should explicitly do, you know, over the next, you know, half there, so, is include some discussion about the measures that are going to be the ones that aren't on the radar screen now but are important given the current organizational forms on the pike, ACOs, medical homes, bundled payment. So things like the care coordination, multidisciplinary teams, and so there's a whole variety of different measures that I know at the wider map we should start to think about, but for disparities, maybe they were particularly relevant in terms of some of these care coordination. Something to move here. He missed your things that you mentioned, Doris.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that's also it's an interesting point in the Affordable Care Act, because that the community health centers are funded, but the specialty care or other links regarding the benefit that we'll hear about upping funding for community health centers is not described and explicated in great detail. Some medical homes, some accountable care, but there's not that, there's that missing link. Sean, and then Grace. Oh, and Mark. Sean,
So I think my main concern about the risk adjustment position isn't that I don't agree with it 90-something percent of the time. It's that when you put in a policy, we haven't really had time to think through and enumerate all the different possible implications, follow it up to its logical conclusions. Is there any scenario in which it may lead to a kind of a counterintuitive result, have the opposite effect of what we're trying to accomplish? And my suspicion is, yes, if we had enough time to think about it, there would be enough counterexamples, problems that we might want to revisit. I think one way I think about quality measurement is one thing measurement does is that you can think about it from the perspective of what type of behavior and change are you trying to affect. And from the perspective of incentivizing and changing, there's a real rationale for not adjusting, not trying to institutionalize racism. But another thing you're doing when you're doing quality measurement is you're trying to measure something. And there may be research applications, there may be internal quality improvement, where you look at the result and you're trying to attach a particular interpretation with it. You're trying to see how your results have changed over time, and if you look at your results and it could be a situation where an institution has really put an intervention in place to improve their quality in some disparity group. And within that group, that population, quality has really, really improved. But the composition, the population composition of that institution changed over time. And so now it looks like they're doing worse. And so that would just be kind of a mistake. It kind of the data fooled them because they didn't analyze it in a way that accounted for the change in their population concentration over time. So I think an alternative approach, instead of saying, let's tackle this issue up front at the phase of risk assessment, is think about other creative out-of-the-box or ways of addressing these issues that I think that probably everyone in the room agrees should be addressed and are important, but just try to figure out other ways of doing it that don't be the challenges of interpretation when we're using these measures to estimate quantities that may have a lot of different purposes.
Thanks. And I think that, to Denise's point, it's just very important that we make it very clear that we've been thoughtful about it and we lay out the various implications, because in rolling out this kind of data to physician groups from a health plan, we've actually provided dashboards where we didn't risk adjust per se, but we showed their performance compared to that of their regions and how their the physician's panels, compared to the panels or the patient population in their region. And we found, the high-performing groups with health disparities and the low-performing groups with no disparities. And when we vetted it with the physician leadership of various groups for feedback, what the answer response got back was, this is very valuable information. It helps us think through what we can implement. But because the claims data may be flawed or the way we bill may differ from group to group, before you think of compensating based on this type of stuff, we really need to resolve kind of these data feed issues and risk adjustment issues. So I think that's the point that we will need to make, is that we can't even think about these different payment models until some of these issues get resolved. But I can say that even without risk adjustments, the physician groups seem to really appreciate this as a quality improvement tool. So we shouldn't let the risk adjustment or not discussion stop us. Right? So.
My first is an apology that I'm going to probably have to run before the conversation ends today to make it to daycare time. But the question that I have is, on this, stratification should be performed when there is sufficient data to do so. Who defines sufficient? Is it an NQF? Does someone get to decide? How does that come into play? Because that's, I think, a big if, depending on how it's defined or how much leeway there is.
Joel, did you have an idea behind it, or are you punting that?
I'm punting it entirely. around these issues. You might think there are statistical tests you can do to determine what would be a statistically stable number. For example, in the Premier demonstration, the rule of thumb is 30. 30 units of quality. And so there's probably some minimum level at which you would feel comfortable stratifying the data by. And other than that, then you would want to roll up into larger categories.
Not on that point, but actually going back to Sean's comments about are there other creative ways, I also just wonder whether there's an option to consider balancing measures here, where, if you're really concerned about the change in the case mix of a population, is there an opportunity to couple an outcome measure where there's not risk adjustment for these factors with an examination of the population or something like that? People have talked about this, for example, when concerns have been about certain providers not taking on the highest risk patients.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to looking at the outcomes of care for those highest risk conditions, you also look at the case mix, mm-hmm. overall to see if, as you know, are they funneling down to the lowest risk patients to get their better outcomes? And so it's kind of just a balance on case mix. So,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, Joel, if you've had any thinking about that. It was just sort of struck me when Sean said, think creatively here about other options.
We certainly thought about risk selection as a way to improve your quality scores. And I think that's why, taking into Mark's comments and others, is that we're sort of often thinking about just one type of policy without trying to think of the bigger picture. And that it's why in other, that I think if you just try one policy lever, then it's always going to be able to be gained. And that the best approach is to use a number of different policy levers to get at the different outcomes that you want to achieve. So, I mean, that's more of a policy question than a measurement question, but no, I wouldn't agree.
Okay, it's settled again then, right?
Can I just ask Helen, is this getting the conversation where you need it to be in terms of the NGO policy?
Yeah, that was very helpful. Yes.
Yeah. I think we're going to, we feel that there's a certain brain drain here.
Really?
So it's been a very intensive day, and I think it's time to perhaps move on to other things. So I think we're going to call it here and pick it up probably with this minor point of consideration of socioeconomic and other demographic variables tomorrow. And that's one of the reasons I think we're going to call it now. What time are we convening for? What's your preferred time? 8?
8 o'clock?
7:30 breakfast, 8 o'clock. Starting at 8. Breakfast at 7:30. So, bon appetit.
You can't leave your things here, so just wanted to mention that. You need to... Hopefully tomorrow we won't spend an hour rearranging the table. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, you were really.